Namaste and in La Ketch, and welcome to this episode of One World in a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and this week's guest is just a phenomenal man that I've gotten to know over the last couple of years, and you're going to really enjoy this conversation. His name is Craig James. He is the managing partner and co-founder of CatStrat Services, which stands for Catalyst Strategies, LLC. He's also a featured contributor at BizCatalyst 360, and we met through the friendship bench that is hosted by Dennis Pataco every week on Thursday mornings. If you've never been there, check it out. It's well worth your stop. Craig is also the host and co-executive producer of Big Audacious Idea. It's a podcast he's been hosting for a while, and I would recommend, if you're not aware of it, go check it out. Phenomenal conversations, and they are evergreen, so they apply here, tomorrow, maybe even 10 years from now. Great stuff. So he talks about strategy, leadership, life coaching, career coaching, and executive coaching. He graduated with a BA in business administration from the University of Akron, and by gosh, he's a neighbor of mine because I was a Hoosier for years. He's been a volunteer as a co-president of the Conscious Capitalism Northeastern Ohio. And with that, Craig, glad to have you here.
Well, had to be here, Zen. Thrilled to be here.
I am as well. And, you know, we've been having a little sidebar beforehand. And what came up for me initially and my desire in speaking with you is observing you and watching you, participating with you. You've got this really wonderful sense of being able to be in process and to share what's going on inside of you that's just so insightful for those who are paying attention to that. Now, I would imagine that comes from a long history of self-examination and that interconnection you've had since you were young, more than likely. If you can recall back to a time when that other connection or that personal connection you had with your inner self became present, what was it like and how did you first become aware of that and how did it fit into your youthful circumstances? Or did it even happen then?
There's a lot in there, Zen.
Of course.
Good question.
Nothing less from me, right?
Thanks for the intro. You know, it's interesting to hear someone interpret your story and tell it to you and share it with others, and it causes one to reflect. I'm humbled by the energy you infused into telling a little bit about my story. I'm taken by the word phenomenal you used a couple times.
I did,
and that's,
I love the word,
and I like playing with words. A friend, Mark O'Brien, we know in common, referred to my word play, called it. It is play.
Yeah, word smithing too.
And examination and receiving the words behind the words. And
the space between the lines, in other words, right?
I think so. And so it's a compliment to say I'm a phenomenal human. Wow. That's humbling, and thank you. But it's powerful. It's also powerful in the sense that it relates to your questions, you know, this inner connection and the when and the how, and you took me back in time. Phenomenal is a key word, I think, because life, universe, is a phenomena. You know, it's not is or was, it's ongoing.
It's a mystery we seek to understand more fully so that we can play better in it, in my opinion.
I think so. I also, you triggered a thought of another human named Margaret Wheatley. Some of your listeners might know of her. She wrote a book called Leadership in the New Science. And one of my favorite little parts of the book was when she talks about information. Now, I grew up in IT. So quickly, I see the word information. I picture, you know, I grew up in the old days, mainframe computers. I picture flashing lights when they used to be big boxes, flashing lights, a lot of moving air and some humming noises and tape reels. And then very quickly flashed through my mind was fewer flashing lights, but bright colors on a desktop workstation. And then now we have our iPhones and the rest and bits and bytes and all that stuff that information is. And her take was entirely different. She took the word information and was talking about that life is everything in a continued formative process.
It's almost like a data stream that we choose how to allow it to appear.
It's always changing. It's always information. Yeah. Otherwise, there's no life. So back to phenomenal. I think that what, in terms of awareness, inner awareness is this weird paradox of like, it's an inner and an outer all at the same time, right? It's not, there's me, whether lowercase s or higher uppercase and physical form or discrete entities. No, it's this very difficult wordless thing to try to describe of awareness of inner yet outer too, because the inner's out, the out is in, neither both.
Exactly. And you bring up a great point. Very insightful. We live half inside and half outside. What we seek to do is bridge those worlds, and we're bereft of the inner for the most part, which is one of the reasons why I started this show, is to talk about this process, especially coming out of COVID now. We're seeking greater connection. We've realized how distant we've become from each other on a global scale now with all the sequestration, right? And that just didn't feel right. So now we're seeking empathic resonance, which is interesting that Matthias DeMott was being interviewed with Tucker Carlson, and this has been probably 6 months or so ago, maybe longer. And he is the author of The Psychology of Totalitarianism. He's I believe a Danish or a Belgian professor. And so he examined the narrative of the pandemic and just broke it down as to how manipulative it was. And then Tucker said, well, what did you find in all of this? And he said, you know, it's interesting. What I really found was something totally surprising. And that's that it seems that we are seeking empathic resonance, which has nothing to do with the prescribed narratives that we've been pummeled with from the exterior world.
Could you feed that to me one more time? Repeat it.
Sure. It's, oh gosh, maybe.
Seeking empathic.
So we're seeking empathic resonance.
Just wanted that phrase clear. Yeah.
We're seeking empathic resonance because we've had the distractions, the disturbance, the discordance, the chaos. And we know from our own science that there is a process from chaos to order. Well, what is it? How do we embody that within ourselves? And that chaos is generally because we have two desperate worlds, desperate and disparate. The desperate is that they want to merge, but because of our thinking, we're in our heads all the time. And so we're forgetting about the body. And as you know, there's an old indigenous philosophy of the three brains, the gut, the heart, and the head, and that we need to process in that order, because we now know via quantum sciences and quantum physics that everything's energy. Well, where do we sense that energy? In the gut. That's why we call it intuition, information.
Right.
And then we process, okay, does it resonate or not?
Yeah.
And then we choose what to do with that because we've got better information from which to make those choices from. And as we learn to tune our bodies as an instrument, then we can develop the ability to play in harmony and possibly even in concert.
Margaret Wheatley again. Interesting, you mentioned quantum physics. Her book Leadership in the New Science does look at human and organizational things through the lens of quantum. It's a really fascinating take, and what I read into it is that, going way back to Dr. Stephen Covey, you know, natural laws. Mm-hmm. And this relates to the when did I sense awareness, interconnectedness?
I figured we'd get to that. Both very tangential, and I love that about this.
Yeah, no doubt. And along the way, since we're tangenting, might as well tangent on the tangent.
Right.
It's all related. You know, I think embedded in there, and some of the things I read that you and I exchanged before this chat, you know, sort of from a global universal sense, what's going on, you know, where are we going kind of thing. So I'm going to go there for a sec, if I may. And sure. In the movie Good Will Hunting with Matt Damon and Robin Williams, and for those who haven't seen it, it's I'll use the word demons, some very difficult things going in this young, brilliant phenom, mm-hmm. Matt Damon, brilliant, but from the quote-unquote societal wrong side of the tracks, and his reconciliation with his brilliance and intelligence and what's really going on inside. And there's a scene, Robin Williams is this therapist. Yeah, they tried everything to fix Matt Damon, the character, Will. And no one could crack this guy. And he's brilliantly cocky and fights. There's scenes of fight, physically and otherwise. And not to ruin the movie for anyone, but at a certain point near the end, there's one of the most conflictual, heated moments between these two characters, Robin Williams and Matt Damon. And you might have to bleep this out. You've probably never heard this word, but I believe Will said to Robin Williams, "Don't fuck with me." Right? And he's pointing, he's veins popping, and they're arguing, fighting. And Robin Williams just quietly takes a breath and looks at him and said, "Will, it's not your fault." And that's when Will gets even more into a fight. "Don't do this to me. Don't do this to me." Panicked in anger, clutching his fist. "Don't do this to me." "Will, it's not your fault." And Will keeps talking and ranting. Mm-hmm. Robin Williams just says, "It's not your fault. It's not your fault." And then there's this watershed moment where all breaks loose and the love erupt between the two characters and everyone in that movie house and anyone in the world. If they couldn't see it and feel it, I'd be shocked. Mm-hmm. And they embrace, and Will weeps deeply. First cry you see that character shed, and it's a full bucket. What I'm getting at is, in that scene, in that moment, there is this incredible anger and dissonance, incredible conflict and fight, and abundant, incredible love and embrace all at the same time. And then I'd be surprised if one doesn't cry after seeing that scene.
I know I did. And I cry at the drop of the hat when I perceive sensitive moments, right? Why not? You feel it, emote, just do it. Don't withhold. And this is, I think, the example of what Robin was showing Matt, was that the self-deprecation that you are imposing upon yourself doesn't need to be there. You're just fine. We love you, right? And it's so difficult for us to accept, you know, we strive. It's like the most we want in life is to love and be loved. And yeah, it's the thing we fight the hardest.
And so that's where we are in the world, I think, right now. We're in that scene.
Yeah.
We're in that scene. where there's this unmistakable, incredible, powerful love abundantly present and an incredible vicious fight at the same time. And there are two sides of the same coin happening right in front of our eyes, and we're in it together, no matter how separate we feel.
Right. And that's where the approach that Robin took. It's not your fault. We're okay. Let's just pause, hug. You know, arms are made for hugging, not fighting.
Yeah.
And enjoy that embrace, because we are all relatives. We all come from the same source, whether we want to agree on the name or not. We're one planet, we're one people. This is one time that we have the opportunity to step up and demonstrate that with some intelligence. Because now science has bridged the gap with spirituality. And what quantum physics and quantum mechanics and quantum sciences in general is beginning to prove is the old Vedantic philosophy that we're all energy coming from a source, we're all divine threads incarnate, and we're capable of being gods and goddesses because we have the consciousness to do so and to manifest those things in the ways that we were designed to do. And we have a real challenge with design in the questioning, the curiosity, because of how we've been structured through the various organizational development schemes, whether it be corporate or religious, because it's all been about controlling the masses and having a way to manage a population to supposedly keep it safe and secure. And at the same time, there's this underlying, I'm not feeling so safe. Right? Mm-hmm. Starting to feel that things are a bit awry, not sure how to express it, but it just doesn't feel right.
Yeah. So
part of what's happening, and I think, and your evidence of it as well, is that we're beginning to talk about this. You know, it's like somebody says something, that just doesn't feel quite right. Let's explore that a little bit, see why.
Right.
And see if we can come to a mutual understanding that's congruent, compatible, and that brings us to a new level of relationship on the ocean of emotion, where we've found safe harbor, at least temporarily, with each other.
I've been using that with a few folks, by the way, relationships on the ocean of emotion. I love that. Very clever, but meaningful. There's beauty in it.
Absolutely. It's the poetry of what comes out your mouth when you just want to be and serve.
Yeah.
In my opinion, anyway.
Pardon moi?
I say in my opinion.
In your opinion. And a couple things strike me as the compatible doesn't have to mean same. I wrote down something too, Zen, that just emerged here, in that I wrote down wise child. And I'll perhaps explain, take the liberty to explain a little bit. So you took me back into...
this is a good segue back into that original circle we started from.
Yes. You know,
we've gone through the tangents now. Let's go back.
Don't worry, listeners. We're getting there.
Yeah.
Hang on.
Right.
Getting there.
You'll love the journey, nevertheless.
And when we get there, I'll be like, is that it? Right. Exactly, the journey. So you took me back to childhood. And it's imagery more than thought. So, you know, that interconnectedness wasn't like, well, there was this sequence and process with certain stage gates that then completed to dependent tasks and milestones that had an outcome of such metric. You know, there's none of that. Zero. It's a picture.
Yeah. Itself. Let's get the strictly business now here, right?
Right, exactly. It's just a picture. It's a feeling. It's basic stuff. It's.
What do you notice about it?
What do I notice about it?
Yeah.
Warmth. Light. Freedom. Everything.
Now, when you were younger, were you cognizant of those reflections Or was it something that you just didn't think about it? And, you know, as a kid, we just are engaging naturally.
I think it was more natural if I, you know, resist overthinking it. It just was. You know, the cognizant, conscious, aware. Here's the paradox again. Yeah, the whole point was, it was all about awareness, right? So that's the whole point. It was drinking in, accepting, receiving, experiencing. But I wasn't conscious of that awareness.
No, because you were just being. You didn't have to be conscious. You were fully in, this is what I perceive anyway.
Yeah.
You were fully in your body. You were just operating. I was much the same way. I didn't know what I couldn't do, tried all kinds of stuff, found out I could do just about anything that I tried to do if I wanted to do it. Therein was the crux of the matter, was, okay, do I want to do this or do I not want to do this?
Right.
And school was the same way. And I had a lot of fun, as I'm sure you did too, because you're a highly intelligent person. I know that just from hearing the words and how you process thing and your tangentialistic aptitude.
Right? Thank you.
You have to be able to, you know, highly intelligent, you can carry on multiple conversations in your head simultaneously. And depending on which one is more relevant to spit out at the time, it comes. And you acknowledge all of those different layers too.
Well, that's fun. I think it's fascinating to think that we can have not only multiple combinations of conversations, but we can have all kinds of experiences at the same time, physical and otherwise. Mm-hmm. Thing back to being a kid in the sunshine, playing in the dirt, part of the freeing aspect was the beauty of not knowing. The pervasive,
not needing to.
The pervasive discovery. The discovery was the whole thing. It was constantly new. Next. What's that? It's question, not answer.
Yeah. Now let's go off on a little different tangent and fast forward that.
Mm-hmm.
How did we lose that? How do we regain that? And like Dennis is doing, how do we reimagine ourselves with that aptitude and attitude more fully present in that childlike curiosity?
Let me drink that in for a second. Mm-hmm. The notion of how did we lose it? So that's a look back. How do we regain it as a look forward? How do we reimagine? I'm going to park that for a second.
In the present.
Yeah. How did we lose it? Well, first, that makes an assumption that we've lost it. I think it's there. Mislaid, maybe. But it's there. It's most certainly there.
I would agree with you wholeheartedly. It seems that we've lost it because we haven't been giving it attention.
Yeah. How do we lose giving it attention? How have we mislaid it or not given it attention? Might have to do with not so much our disconnection from it, but perhaps a pull to other. I'm thinking out loud here. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're listening to a song, but a jet flies by and then there's a traffic jam and a siren, it's not like the music isn't there. It's just, I hear all this other stuff first.
And have you ever noticed that sometimes those things are synchronistic? Now, I'll give you an example. I hadn't thought about this for years till you just mentioned this. I was playing in a reggae band as a percussionist, early 90s, and we were playing a gig at a opening of a Goodwill, and we had a carnival and all kinds of stuff. It was in a really nasty part of town. And during one of the songs that we were playing, the activity around us linked up. It synced up, including sirens and cars and noise. And it was this amazing full expression of a moment that was so integrated that it was ineffable, right?
I can't believe this shit's going on. I'm going to just interrupt. I can't help it because I'm just chuckling here. If there's video here, you'll see me looking all over the place and giggling. It's because it's talk about synchronicity, serendipity. I kid you not, I was going to write, I haven't yet found the right moment. Yesterday, I experienced exactly what you're speaking to, but I had to play a part too.
Mm-hmm. Well, we always do.
And there's this car alarm in the neighborhood going on. I'm out on our balcony, and one could be very agitated by it, but I was in just a different frame of mind, looking up at a sunny day, and I'm trying to remember what this is dangerous if I try to sing a song here, but it's like da 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 da, whatever that famous piece is.
Okay.
I hummed it to the car alarm. And it was fun to play with this alarm somewhere instead of fight it, you know?
Right.
And so the cool thing about that and what I wanted to write about is we could curse the car alarm. Damn it, who is that? Doggone it, they shouldn't, all that stuff.
Right.
Or play with it, because when it stopped, I was sad. It's like, oh, you know, we were playing. Don't stop now. And so a couple things emerge for me as we talk here is what how do we lose it? Well, maybe we didn't lose it. There's other things pulling us from tuning into it. I was about to say, therefore, maybe we need to find the quiet to access and hear what we think we've lost.
Mm-hmm.
But what you just helped with here, me see, is wait a second, maybe we include the car alarms and the jet and the traffic jam. Come on in. I love this because we have to, you know, part have to, right?
Part of what is, right? If nothing's separate, then we better accept everything as a whole.
Push this stuff out so I can tune into that thing, like, you know, when I was a kid. No, maybe it's just like, how about the car alarm's a tune? And let's have it be part of the conversation and connect what we think is separate from it being the thing we think.
Or the car alarm's a bill that's coming due that you're not sure you can pay. And so you're stuck in the responsibility that you need to have in order to pay that bill and the things that are necessary in order to do that. And that's a huge distraction from being in the quiet space.
But can the noise be part of the quiet? I guess what I'm wondering.
Well, that's how we learn. It's like Rene Rilke, right? Rene Maria Rilke. He says you have to live with the question. And Einstein says you can't solve problems with the same thinking that created them.
Yeah.
So you have to just be with it for a moment. And that moment may be short. It may be extended.
Mm.
And allow that process to unfold with the attention, intention, and interaction on it in the quest of resolution. Because you know internally it can be. There's something there that can weed through all of the stuff that's feeling you, that's causing you to feel disconnected. And it's usually your ability to feel connected and just be able to step back and realize that you are a part of everything. You're not separate from it. And then how do I learn to play better with the stuff that is in front of me to do? And that includes the gamut of, you know, the stuff that you really can't stand to do, but have to in order to get things done. My dad used to tell me, you know, tackle the worst thing first and then the rest will be gravy, right? And you don't have the stress that is weighing over your, you know, getting that thing done. You're trying to get all the little things done because that big thing is still, you know, weighing on your consciousness. And the thing is that when you take care of the little things all along, the big stuff will take care of itself.
Sure. And certainly going back to Dr. Covey again, you know, Big Rocks First. A lot of folks have run with that and repurposed it. You know, but the little pebbles in the sand fits in the jar when you put the big rocks in the jar first. If you try to do the other way around, you don't have the space. Mm-hmm. You can't fill in the gaps. That's a beautiful metaphor. What this part of our conversation then prompts for me too, and as a coach, I find working with clients quite often, the relationship with done is a big topic. And it's huge in our society.
Are we ever done?
Right. Back to information. Mm-hmm. Done might mean death. So our obsession with doneness is fascinating and worth exploration. And even to question, and you know, what characterizes doneism in the first place, you know, or doneration, you know, and how about the why part? That was one of the first things that you asked. Why do you do what you do, and how do you do it? Simon Sinek has done a great job taking to market the why question.
Yes.
But why do you do what you do? And there's the do three. I'm looking at the sentence now, the lower part of my screen. One short sentence, the word do three times, and done is the extension of do. And one wonders, what do we care? Why do we care about doing, period?
This is what we've been, because of how we've been programmed, that this is the process, right? You got to do in order to have, and so you can be, right? Mm-hmm. Well, flip that. It's like the fool. Right. Start with being first, because that's the core of who we are. Then the doing can take place because you have a little better sense of what to do, because you're in that being state. You're curious, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What am I here to do? Who am I? What's my purpose? How can I serve in this moment? And it really is. Yes, there's an importance in looking long-term as to what your life impact is to serve. And yet it's those moments in which we serve that we show up and be present. Right? Mm-hmm. Like Mandino and the precious present. What a gift to be able to be in the moment. Then when you approach it with that attitude of, what's here? What's good for me? What can I offer? How can I give? Then you're not so preoccupied with what can I receive from this. And I think that may be what the majority of us have been misperceiving as the precursive notion of, you know, what can I get out of this?
You know, there's a guy named Rick Rubin. I don't know if you know of him. Rick Rubin, do you know that name? I didn't either. And thanks to a new client, one of the gifts of coaching is, and I told this fellow this, I don't know who benefits more and who's learning more from whom here.
I know. It's reciprocal, you know.
It's a beauty.
Teacher that flips constantly.
That's in a good way. It's like cheating. I mean, it's a gift. And so this fellow exposed me to Rick Rubin, and it was humbling to be compared. I didn't know about this guy. I don't look like anything like him. In terms of he's got this big beard, and people could judge societally what he looks like. And he's in the music business. There's big names that look to him as essentially a spiritual guide for their musical endeavors. And he's somewhere in California, LA, whatever, and typically producers and agents, and I don't understand that world enough to properly give him a title, but gents or women in that role, they tend to have these flashy studios with platinum records on the wall and equipment everywhere and accolades and awards. Mm-hmm. His studio, in large part, is like a room with a view of nature and a pillow. And he listens with his eyes closed, earbuds in, working with his clients. And that's like he's like the Zen master of the music biz, and it's a room with a pillow and nature. I mean, and a lot of it's silent. And he was asked, Anderson Cooper was interviewing him on 60 Minutes, this one interview, and he said, you know, do you work with your clients, these big names, to you know, to get the platinum, and how many sales? Never once. If that's what you're shooting for, I'm not for you. I'm looking for what's in someone's heart and their soul and help them access it. That's it. End of story. And he told this one woman, I don't know the artist. So a listener might say, Craig, how don't you know of Keisha? I don't know of Keisha until now. Keisha was saying, I'm stuck to Rickon, and I can't write this next song. And he said, here's the deal. Here's the homework. Just write everything you want to write and don't stop until you have nothing left, and just keep writing. Don't, it's got to be this outcome. It's got to be the next hit. It's got to be of this certain cadence or length. Just write what you want to write and don't stop until you've got nothing left. And she said, then it arrived. So by not forcing consciousness of it's got to achieve X is when you get there.
Right.
And that's counter, you know, you've got your advanced degrees. I went to business school. I'm a business guy. I grew up in business. I get plans and metrics and all stuff we could talk about.
Well, not just in business. You grew up in IT.
IT, yeah, the business side of IT, correct, yes.
Which is moving that data from one place to another and making sure it flows effectively.
So, exactly. So the idea, I could see some dissonance here, you know, if I'm listening, but you don't just like, you just kind of stop and things will just happen in business. Come on, get real, Craig. I'm still reconciling that in a large part because I do appreciate plans, metrics, you know.
Sure, sure. And those were there for a reason. What I found is that when, and maybe you can reflect on this too, and I invite you to, that when it doesn't eliminate strategy and planning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It accentuates it. Because
right.
When you're clear, when you're essentially empty, you can ask better questions. Every question has an answer. Are you asking the right ones? Right. And in order to get to the right questions, you step back, you find that quiet place, you look at things from with new eyes. And especially if you can bring somebody in from the outside that's got, you know, the ability to see from that place and offer insights, or at least new questions you may not have thought about before, then mm-hmm. it helps you develop those questions as well and fit it in to the model, whether it's a business model or something else. And it works better that way.
You know, the and language is popular these days, and both, not or. Mm-hmm. Jim Collins wrote about that a million years ago, the tyranny of or and the power of and. It's a powerful notion for sure, but you know, there's a lot behind it to be explored. And what you're speaking to, Zen, is that it's very insightful, and you're taking away the dichotomy in terms of allowing and planning. They can coexist. They are actually
absolutely, and they must coexist.
They're interdependent.
Right. And you're familiar with Sharmer's model, theory U.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not deep, but I've been exposed to it and read a little.
That's the operational capacity of it. You bring people together, you work on what they call co-presencing, which means there's no ego without we go.
Okay.
And you settle in that open inquiry and then proceed from there in prototyping what needs to emerge, because you're all part of that process, and based on your skill set, you can see it from that perspective and add to it so that it all becomes a holistic organism.
So to build on that, and going back to the, how do we lose? How do we regain? How do we reimagine?
Wonderful.
You know, past, future, present, reflection there. I'm looking at the regain part right now, the forward view, and maybe it's a reimagine. So the forward depends perhaps on our present. I think one of the things that hits me as we talk, Zen, is the a turbocharged and-ness is necessary.
With emphasis.
One more time.
I said with emphasis.
And with emphasis, you got it. Exactly. I like that. Well said. You know, I think that just like allowing and feeling and being can coexist and is interdependent with planning and strategy and metrics, I think business, earthly things like economy, earthly truly things like environment, all these big, huge things that dominate our consciousness, but we have a hard time transporting into the future. In some ways, we're so present focused, mm-hmm. an inability to think of those.
And longer. We're afraid that we can't be or do enough to curtail the momentum we've been experiencing.
So to regain, I think that if we can somehow have that cake and eat it too, I'll fumble through words here for a sec. And I think if we can be practical, logical, thoughtful, planful, you know, like Danny Kahneman will say in Thinking Fast and Slow, for those of your listeners who have read that, it's a fascinating read on intuition versus logic. How do you trust one or the other when one plays, when one might masquerade and be mistaken as the other? I think if we can find a way increasingly for the future to be practical, thoughtful, analytical when appropriate, when necessary, and not be afraid to inject and allow the things like love. This is something in some of the things you asked me through electronic communication before we're talking that had to do with me. So I'm talking globally and me. Mm-hmm. I know for me, this is where the wise child thing comes to the picture, back to into the picture, is that I'll be 60 in this time, at the time of this recording, I'll be 60 in a week. And therefore I feel a certain arrival in terms of wisdom and like, wow, I felt like I've learned some things and having the confidence to be where I am in life and help perhaps and serve others. Yet at the same time, just as powerful. Mm-hmm. is I feel like that kid in the sunshine all at the same time, completely unknowing and ignorant of so much.
And therein is where the faith, love, and trust emerges. Right? Because you know enough to know enough. Mm-hmm. And that it gives you that foundation from which to move into the unknown with less fear. If not, no fear, because you've had the experience of that process. It's interesting. And congratulations on your 60th. I just turned 66 not too long ago. And with the sixth sense, who knows? You know, there was a number that still brings up query when it's actually just the carbon atom, 6 protons, 6 electrons, and 6 neutrons. That is the number of man. So to be interpreted by knowledge or by... knowledge and wisdom, I think, is what it stated. What I wanted to get to was that in this emerging space that we're having, there is a consistency in being able to understand, acknowledge, explore, be fearless in, and open up to that expression of love, which has no requirements. It just is. It's energy, right? Whether we want to call it God, energy, love, whatever, the purest sense of that is simply what I've learned. You know, it's that sense of awe that we were talking about, you know, pre-show, and that it brings with it that if you listen really deeply, there's a very high-pitched tone. And if you tune it to it even more, there's a sense of effervescence and iridescence with it. It's that wild child energy, right? It's just, it's got this creative font that it may not know what to do with yet. And yet it's there.
I'm grateful that you said wild child. We talked about wild and the word wild earlier in your conversation with another friend named Andy, and that word came up. It's funny, I wrote down wise child, actually, which was this idea of arrival yet birth all at the same time, neophyte and knowledgeable together. Mm-hmm. But I love the wild.
Well, the two seem to be congruent, right? And they dovetail in that what society generally does with that wise child who is explorative, who has no boundaries, that is inquisitive and doesn't know the meaning of no, why, is seen as a wild child. Right. Think about the teachers in classrooms and your experience with teachers. And I've been on both sides of the fence. I was a wild child in the classroom. And as a teacher, I had to learn to incorporate the wild child in the class or wild children in the classroom, which really was a wonderful experience because you can tame energy. You can't create it from a child that's sitting in class listlessly.
Yeah.
On whatever, you know, cocktail they've been given to try to control whatever disorder they may have. Seemingly.
There's a whole discussion to be had, perhaps, about institutional.
We're opening up all kinds of doors here that
industrial
the others will have the ability to carry on and ripple through the thoughtosphere further. So how did you find ways to incorporate this in your service to humanity, your clients, okay, your relationship, and how did that make sense common around you?
How did that make sense common around me?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it would make sense, right? It just feels. That's the empathic resonance. Oh, that makes sense. Truth resonates when you hear it.
I think if I look at the recent past, there's a how-to question there, isn't it? How mm-hmm. have I? The temptation is to use the word allow again. It's I'm going to give it a judgment. It's been overused a little bit, not just overall. It's a powerful word, but it's not doing justice right now.
Mm-hmm.
I believe other companion words are trust and courage to not just allow, but receive, to recognize it. To recognize that thing in your heart you know is pure. And to resist, not just recognize, potentially resist the filters, often societal, that say, oh no, shouldn't do that, shouldn't say that, shouldn't think that. 60-year-old guys don't well up in tears and tell another guy, and I'm not going into judgment around choice, none of that. I'm just, it happens to be, I'm heterosexual.
Me too, and I still well up. I hug men and I cry.
But society would, you know, well, no, you just don't say I love you. And it's not just the phrase, by the way.
Yeah.
But to receive, to trust that thing that's pure, and you feel it, you know it. And we've got all kinds of filters that tell us, no. Armor is Brene Brown.
And what happens when you first get in touch with that feeling, that release of reception, right? Or release to receive. What happens in your body when that happens?
What happens to my body?
Yeah.
It's recognizing. It's recognizing quite often there is a like a electrical vibration tingle feeling. You know, there's the classic
goosebumps. Warm fuzzies, spine. Right?
Pardon me?
Warm fuzzies.
It's powerful, man. You just, I feel that. I feel a magnetism. If there's another human involved, it's just, you feel drawn. You feel also some resistance. This is a thinking, not a feeling necessarily, but I feel when we think, we often think with our mouths and the muscles around. And part of the push pull is sort of like hold it back feeling. And it's all the moment to trust to not hold it back. Mm-hmm. But I can literally feel, don't say that. That will be blank, 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 blank judgment. That'll be too fuzzy, too silly, too touchy, too whatever, too, but. And I can not only think that, but I can feel that. And I'm learning.
And you tense up because of it. Your energy, you know, energetically, you compress.
Definitely.
And which closes the doors to the flow.
So I'm learning to recognize that. And that's mm-hmm. a signal to realize now's the time to release. Sure, there's times perhaps where our judgment mind comes in. There are circumstances where if I'm feeling highly connected and emotionally loving, let's say in a moment, well, real love would be, is the other party in this moment capable of receiving right now? And so sometimes there's a logic process that comes into play and mm-hmm. it's still out of love.
Right.
But mostly,
it's also preemptive in some ways because you really don't know what or where the other person is because you haven't asked them.
Right, exactly. So there's a practical element here. Mm-hmm. That said, I'm finding when I err on, just let it rip, Craig. Just let it rip. If you're feeling it, say it. Has been very powerful. It's been very powerful and it's been very meaningful. And maybe a few folks are, whoa, didn't expect that coming. I had one of those yesterday. And the topic was love. Yeah. And it was a question.
And our mutual friend, Andy, right? This is what I love about her. She's just present, raw, real. There's no question. And the energy that she exudes is that of love and just wanting to be free herself. And so how can we allow others to be free if we aren't?
And we go through a lot of things in our society. Well, wait a second, but this role, that role, this relationship, and we can't, that's not appropriate, whatever. And I'm learning. I'm not fully there and I don't know what there is even, but I'm learning to just.
I don't know if there's a there, but there's always a here.
Exactly. So it's a journey, as you said earlier. It's a journey. Those are some of the things.
Cool. So and I really love how we've allowed this conversation to evolve and the different places that we've been going so far. I want to continue that in this transition that we are in from there to here. Are you noticing that there is a sense of, and you mentioned the word courage, you know, courage being the fear that said its prayers, I've heard. And that in taking it back to Will or Matt and Robin, right?
Right.
When he finally felt like he was able to at least be open to, maybe not fully receive, but at least be open to, it caught my butt there. He was able to release to that. And this is where I was getting in the other question I asked is, what's it feel like? How does it well up in you when you're in that sense of real deep love in the moment and you're in recognition of it because it wasn't there previously. And now it is. There's often this welling up for me, and I tear up. It's and I don't know if it's joy or the awe or the just the willingness of you know how it feels to be in that place. Does that happen with you?
It does, and literally well up for sure when my heart is at some sort of place of love. It's a well up for sure. And what I also love about it is a sense of lack of control. And we might be prone to think of that as a bad thing, right? We need to control things. It's a release feeling, a relief in a way. Mm-hmm.
Oh. Oh. Well, it's like, yeah. I just had this image come up. So January 2nd, 1995, we decided to jump out of a plane as our New Year's release, right? So never done before. It was a static jump. I was solo. And jumping out of the plane, it was cool. You know, you step out, you grab the wing, and then you just fall back. And then when the line reaches its end and it pulls the chute out, you go tumbling in space and you have no idea where you're at, what's going on. And there's this moment of, oh shit, I'm totally out of control. And then the chute opens.
Beautiful metaphor.
And serene. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
Complete flip.
Yes. That is super cool. Way to look at this. No doubt. It's that kind of thing. So the lack of control, the beauty of that is the relief and the calm that can come with that. And we associate lack of control with chaos, bad. And then we discover after a little tumble that we're floating.
Right. And there's one more element.
Yeah.
Trust.
Yeah.
Trust in the process. You engage it, let it do its work.
Trust, yes. And then also the thing that hits me, and this is maybe a thought, or no, it's a feel.
Okay.
Not a physical feel. It's not like feel it in the body. It's a different kind of feel. There's this thing that is hard to describe. We often, in these kinds of conversations, talk about oneness or we, not me. There's this godly-like feeling. I don't mean godlike in the sense of like some powerful being that now controls what happens and sends lightning bolts or whatever.
It's more like you understand.
Yeah. And I feel that kind of divine energy mm-hmm. feeling.
Why are we so resistant to this? Because I agree. You reach that place and it's like a bird's eye view of just a moment where everything is pure.
Why do we resist it? It's a good question. I mean, it's assuming we resist it. We do. Yeah, we do.
It's a blasphemous comment when you start talking to some of you know, hey, we're gods and goddesses in embryo, even though it's in scripture and all the other you know, spiritual texts from around the world throughout history. Mm. And yet we still, oh, you can't, right? That's the first thing you get from another person. Oh, you can't be God. What do you think, you're God?
Right. Why do we resist it? I mean, the easy pat answer is fear, but that's not complete. There's something else at work. Why do we resist it?
Maybe it's because we don't.
Maybe because it's too real. Maybe it's so real it's scary.
Mm-hmm. The spooky coolness of awareness.
It's what?
The spooky coolness of awareness.
Right. Right. If to continue to explore this, we might. Like one of the if I resist it, it might be. Oh, I even qualified it in our conversation here a little bit. Mm-hmm. Oh. Like in society, we don't want to show up, be better, be superior. Some do.
Exactly. But, it's not about that.
Yeah,
so right. It's an individual connection with our divine intelligence, if you will. And we each have it. You know, we were talking about the various aspects and spinoffs and tangents and things like that. Well, even with today now, there was actually it's been almost 13 years ago. It'll be December when this information was released. It was the Theory of Everything paper that Vernon Nepi and Edward Close wrote. And in that, they posited that consciousness, space, and time are tethered across 9 dimensions for the human experience. Doesn't eliminate other dimensions, just that we are humanly limited to that because we're in physical form and that's what we've got. Well, we just have barely explored the first, let alone 9 more or 8 more or however that may look. I think it's actually 9 more because we're used to this one. And what that caused in me was a reflection of an experience I had back in 1989 of a similar process, of a direct experience of integrating, of going to each one of those 9 planes and integrating my body on each one of those areas of bandwidth. And that process was developed by William Swigard back in the 1950s. So here we are, 60 years later, there's science to back up the experience. And I was just so elated. And it's funny how I found it. I was preparing for an interview with Jeffrey Mishlove for his show called New Thinking Aloud. And it was a 28-year dream for me from starting my first show in 1990 and wanting to emulate Jeffrey and Bill Moyers as my go-to guys for my interviewing style. And I hoped someday I would be worthy of an interview with one of them. And in 2018, Jeffrey reaches out to me through a ufology press site that I had with an interview that he'd done with a guy on the Grays. And he says, "Hey, I think your audience would love this. Would you take a look at it and help promote it?" And so I listened to it, wrote a blog article, posted it, sent him the links along with a PDF copy of my big book, Stubbing My Toe on Purpose, a seminal view of consciousness, cosmology, and the congruence of science and spirituality. Say that fast. And 3 days later, I get an email back from him. He says, "Hey, would you like to come talk about it?" Mm. So it just took my own sense of credibility and broke through the glass ceiling that I had created for myself.
I've got a question for you, if I may.
Oh, yeah. I'm open.
So sort of in the sequence of the how did we lose, how do we regain, how do we reimagine past, future, present, a lot of it has to do with our right now. First of all, the 9 dimensions and perceiving what we think is everything. I mean, that's fascinating to me. And it's rather heady of us to think, whoa, everything we see is what is. A grasshopper in the backyard can't see Cleveland Hopkins Airport right now. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just they have a limited purview.
Right.
So why wouldn't it be the same? I mean, most likely there's a bunch of stuff we can't see or perceive. Of course, really. I think that's really interesting, actually, and it's super cool to think that time might be just a complete tool we invented to perceive how we can perceive, but there's so much more to that.
Guys from elsewhere say that it's a measurement in the change of entropy.
Interesting. My question to you.
Yeah.
So in our present state, though, we perceive what we can perceive, we use what we can use, the tools we have are what we have.
Well, that would be Ohio and Arizona, right?
Ohio and Arizona, right. Communication and words and sound waves coming out of mouths into ears and eardrums is right now a lot of how we communicate. We're doing that right now. And one of the things that I, you know, in the green room before we were recording here, we're talking about some of our history together and what we have in common, the friendship bench as an example. And I was humbled by your noticing me. And I noticed you too back then. but I couldn't tune in until recently. And I could see where some judgment here, some can't or just are in different realms from Cleveland, Arizona, metaphorically, and just can't see, can't hear. It's that, you know, we need an amplifier. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what you, my question to you is the language you use, the thinking, the translation, if you might, into sort of earthly, I'll say Western production, consumption, material mindset. How do you bridge, how do you get over and communicate with, or how have you, or is it something that you, hey, look, it clicks with those with whom it clicks, end of story, it doesn't matter, I don't try. What, do you have a conscious take on how you communicate some of this?
I do, and I've worked on it for decades. And depending on, you know, my first show, I interviewed 120 shows, interviewed over 200 people, and with two guests. And I would choose people from disparate backgrounds and learn how to listen deeply enough to recognize they're saying the same thing, and then bridge those languages.
Okay.
Now I do that for my, as an educator, I had learned I had to, and I taught high school for 8 years. I had to learn how to speak to the most brilliant as well as the least brilliant in the classroom. And mm-hmm. So there was various ways of delivering. And so you would reiterate things multiple ways in using different languages in order to do so. And so depending on the group or the individual, I do my best to kind of be in that presence. And now it's more of just a natural occurrence where I'm paying attention. My attention, intention, and interaction is on being available to speak and articulate in the ways that can be understood, because I spent 40 years or almost 50 years of not being understood at the very core levels from which I hope to speak from, because they were from that wise child place that seemingly was bereft of an ear at the time.
Imagine you, and I know this is going to be amorphous because it's a fake scenario, but it's based on a real one. And it would, if it was real, it'd be more quote unquote mine than yours. So it makes it difficult perhaps for you to say, here's what you do. But if imagine there's a hard driving CEO and she is type A, materially successful, monetarily successful. Let's say she's in technology, continued rocket ship in terms of material Western capitalist success.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say you cared about that person and felt the need, that's maybe a selfish thing on my part, felt the need to pierce, so to speak.
Pierce the veil.
Go here. Pardon me?
To pierce the veil.
Pierce the veil, right. And not impose, look, I think this way and have this awareness and you need to too, because if she doesn't, then that doesn't matter. It's her. But you feel, no, there's some intuitive sense. And I realize the moment that person would be in this conversation, they would politely say, thanks, guys, got to go.
Not for me. Sure.
And it might be just not for me. And that's it.
I'm not interested in it at the level that we are speaking, right? It just has no bearing for them. However, if you were to engage them in some kind of consultancy role, right, then you'd ask questions. You wouldn't say, what about this? What about, you know, that kind of question. You would ask, how do you notice when, what do you notice when, are there others involved in helping you be and stay where you are? And how does that work? And how much attention are you giving that in order to nurture those so that the machine works?
Do I hear you saying slight tweaks early on, maybe spoonfuls versus watershed?
Fire hosing, yeah, fire hosing is not ever a good idea, because the first thing you're going to do is get resistance and blowback. So you go in humbly and you ask simple questions, leading them to, in my opinion, especially now, leading to what a servant leadership role would entail.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you're doing, it's the people that help you do it.
Thanks. Okay.
Welcome.
What else?
Well, actually, we are approaching. So let's go this direction for just a little bit. What have you found was a most critical insight, observation, recognition, reflection of self that made the biggest difference in your growing awareness?
There's two, but you just said biggest, and the second one came to mind. I was going to go to the first. The first was a time when I was, Sue, my partner in life and business, we were leading a retreat, a multi-day retreat, and we were spent at the end, and that opened a door where I believe I encountered, I was told, I didn't know what was happening, encountered my higher self, capital S, that was a figure leaning against a wall in a gaze with a hat, and he had his sort of his elbow and his hand on his chin, and he said to me, "You got it, kid." And that was a sixth person in the room, and there were only five. And we were putting plates out for this after retreat. The coordinators, we were the primary coordinators of it, and breaking bread together and kind of assembling the last food that was left from the first couple of days to make a meal. Mm-hmm. And I was the one who said, "We need a sixth plate." And I was like, "Craig, would you, five of us?" And no, we need six, because there was this other entity there. That was notable. That was the first. The biggest was when my dad was dying and I had the opportunity to be there with him. We did. My mom, Sue, and I were with him. And, was when he transitioned before he died, and his gaze went from fear to wonderment, and we were looking at each other, but we weren't my dad and me. That's when I felt that godly feeling.
It's when we're empty. And I think that's what we call, it's been called, is this, we're empty.
Yeah. Right?
We're constantly trying to fill our cups instead of emptying them.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
allowing them to be filled.
In that moment,
that kind of experience,
I knew something is going on. Yeah.
Well, I would think that, you know, having the guy show up out of nowhere and disappear, and right? Because that's kind of what I believe you alluded to.
Yeah.
You know, there was a guy back many, 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 many years ago. His name was Melchizedek. And he was said to have shown up without a beginning of days and without ending of days. He just showed up, gave a lesson, and split.
Right. Yeah.
So if those kinds of things are available, there's this precipitation or condensation into form that those who have developed and evolved to that place of not needing form, still having consciousness, then there's that capacity of moving in between dimensions and showing up when necessary in order to impart certain wisdom.
And right now, Zen is, in a way, an evolution of some of that awareness. I'm not saying there's like a Shazam moment happening right now as much as, yeah, Craig, trust it. That's that guy. You got it, kid, is what he said to me.
Yeah.
Not too long ago, I'd be afraid to say this out loud unless the most intimate settings and knowing it's recorded and people listen. I would have these fear tapes. There's still some of that there. because, you know, wait, I'm a business guy, I'm a coach, I'm an executive coach, I'm practical. But you're talking about a guy leaning against the wall with the hat. I don't think and you know what? Well, then fine. I have the business skill, capability, and knowledge. I'm not afraid to say that out loud.
And it's your experience you're sharing.
And this thing happened too. It doesn't make me unintelligent in business suddenly, or scary that I'm too woo-woo or something. This is something I experienced.
And this is a point I'd like to make too. We have belief systems, we have experience systems. And what I've had to do is I've had to suspend my belief systems because the experiences that I was having didn't fit.
Yeah, I get it.
So you have to expand it. And I would suggest, and how do you now, having those kinds of things, do you base your daily deliberations and movements on an experience system as opposed to a belief system now?
It's shifting.
Okay.
I think we
still have those, you know, deep beliefs, you know, like that we're here to love and be loved. That's a belief on one hand. What's the experience of that like to prove it true?
Right. And I think probably my inability to answer that very clearly is still processing the definition of experience and belief and what the operational definitions of those words are. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm grasping it mostly. Yes, I'm more and more finding opportunities for those to coexist as they can. I'm thinking about coaching settings in particular, and being less afraid to the stuff that's been most useful, I think, in coaching has been when it's we experience something together. You know, we don't talk about concepts and theories. Sometimes we do, but it's when we're being together. And some might, maybe even if you don't fire hose it, it might just be too much. And if so, I respect that. But I won't let the fear of that stop it now more and more. Again, does that mean reckless abandon with just, woo, let everything rip? I had an intake with a new client today. We went through a form and did the formal stuff. There's timing. There's timing involved, and there are practical realities that I still subscribe to.
Well, sure. Well, but, and this kind of not necessarily reckless abandonment, fearlessness allows you to perform better in those things that are more prescriptive.
Yeah. Yes, I would agree with that. Thank you for that. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I'm all excited here. What's cool is like now moment. So it's, I find a real kick out of like, imagine I'm somebody, some other human listening to this right now on December 14th of 2023. I'm just making that up.
Yeah.
And that what's so cool about that is that the now that is now, it was right now for the ears that just heard me say that, but the now that's then is 3 months ago or 4 months ago, which is the now, which is August 23rd when we're having this conversation. Sorry, 23rd, where did I come from? 30th, mm-hmm. August 30th. And I'm excited about that because you're on the moon right now. And we get a second one this month. And we've got our blue moon tonight at 9:34 Eastern PM. I couldn't think of a better day for us to chat.
It seems like we were destined to step into this moment, doesn't it?
It does.
And it's just a wonderful sensation to be in this place and to have this conversation and to let it spill out. And you're also giving me this, whether you realize it or not, nudge to go live.
To do what?
To go live instead of doing the recording and airing, because I'm a force of one and with wanting to be present and accountable, I don't want to be distracted by having to take care of technology at the same time. So,
gotcha.
And you know, my wife Luba, she's just a godsend to me twin flame epitome of it. And being from Russia, growing up in St. Petersburg, it's the obvious connection of two world powers that are seemingly enemies.
Yeah.
We've been able to bridge in our relationship and find out, oh, we're really a lot the same.
Well, Zen, let's do it. I love you, pal.
I love you too. And this has just been amazing. And I look forward to seeing you again too. And for now, I will say thank you so much for this time and your being and our connection.
And thank you.
So great to have you. And namaste and in la catch. Thanks for sticking with us for this episode of One World and a New World. I'm Zen Benefiel, your host, and I will see you next time.